Mark Maron. It's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition. All right, good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, working class heroes, lurking conservatives, limousine liberals who think that civil rights is how you treat your nanny. You know who you are. Good morning, Mark Riley.
Good morning.
These are the last days of Morning Sedition, my friends, and I'm sorry to say that is true, despite the hundreds of emails that I've received, that we've received here at the show. Thank you for all your support. Certainly appreciate it. I've done what I can here. I don't know what to tell you, folks. I really don't know what to tell you. This is a decision being made by one guy. All right, this is a decision being made by one guy who's wanted to shut this show down since he got here. That's it. And that's the long and short of it. I don't know. He claims that it's not about money. He claims that he likes me. He claims that he doesn't listen to IMUS. He claims that he doesn't sit in his office and play solitaire. I know two of those things are a lie, people. And look, you know, I don't know what to tell you. I'm trying to do my job. I don't know when they're going to yank me off the air. I don't know what's going to happen. The future of myself here, and I'm being honest with you because you're asking me to be candid and you're asking me to be honest, is that my contract negotiations came up at the beginning of this month, today. They had to let me know by today whether they would keep me as host of Morning Sedition, you know, starting December 1st. They have told me that I will no longer be host of Morning Sedition, you know, as of December 1st. So that means right now I'm in this weird gray area where they're retooling whatever they're going to retool. And, you know, who knows? You know, I'm sure many of you will enjoy what they have planned. You know, Mark Riley is probably going to remain here. We're going to find out what's going on with that. That's why he's not saying anything, because this, you know, this is about me right now, unfortunately. And that's where it stands right now. But I certainly appreciate all of your support. I hope to God that I have some sort of presence here. I imagine if I'm not careful about what I say, I could be off the air by the end of the week. So I'm going to try and be diplomatic for the good of the show. I love being here. I love doing this. We built this thing out of nothing. And, you know, without a tremendous amount of guidance either. I'm very proud of the show, and I'm very proud to have so many people listening and enjoying what we're doing here, and that can be told by the hundreds of emails that we've received. I'll talk more about this later as more people show up to our party this morning, but let's get into the news. All right, Riley?
Yeah.
All right, let's do that. Let's start with a little local politics, if you could, because it seems to me that Michael Bloomberg, my friend, is starting to look like a bully. I mean, this guy apparently has it in the bag, okay? And yet he's still beating the hell out of Ferrer on ads. I mean, doesn't he risk, and I'm not saying that I have a problem with it, but doesn't he risk people saying, hey, come on, take it easy, Mike? I mean, you know what I mean? You got the money, quit beating up on Freddie.
Well, there was one article over the weekend in one of the papers here in New York that said just that even some of Michael Bloomberg's supporters were becoming concerned, because with a lead that is anywhere from 27 to 31 points in the polls, Mike Bloomberg didn't need to hammer at Freddie Ferrer quite as much as he had. Now,
yeah,
that may have changed the other day with the debate that took place, because I think Freddie Ferrer held his own in the debate, and of course there's another debate tonight.
Okay.
So there's a real possibility that Ferrer can eat into that lead with another feisty performance. But you're right. At this point, people are starting to question, like, you bringing an anvil to squash an ant? I mean, what is the problem here?
Yeah, I mean, you would think that it's like it becomes an issue of hubris. It becomes an issue of, like, take it easy. We get it. It becomes an issue of, like, do you really want to govern or do you just want to own the town? It's a sort of a misuse of power and a misuse of money to almost victimize your opponent. I mean, I know that might be part of politics, but here in New York, I think it looks stinky. It looks stinky to me.
Well, I'll tell you, the problem is, it's his money.
Yeah.
I mean, Mike Bloomberg is likely to spend up to $100 million getting reelected to a job, by the way, that pays him exactly $1 a year. He doesn't take a salary.
Yeah, I know, but that's sort of like Danny Goldberg saying he's working for nothing. I'm not gonna buy that whole sort of $1 a year thing as validating this guy as some sort of champion of human rights. You know what I mean?
Oh, no. It's not a question of validating him as champion of human rights. The man has, I believe, something on the order of $4.6 billion at his disposal. So $100 million to get reelected mayor is chump change to him.
Exactly. So let's move into the rest of the country, who's going to pay for Bush's decisions once again. I mean, as you know, yesterday he nominated Samuel Alito it's hard not to say that this is what you get to some people. Look, a lot of you people who are Democrats, a lot of you people who are liberals, you know who you are. You didn't vote it. You knew this was coming down the pike. You knew that the possibility of at least one Supreme Court justice was going to be nominated, during this term. Perhaps the election was stolen, but I'm still mad at the fact that this wasn't made a bigger issue during the campaign. Now we should get behind our reps. I'm telling you, get behind your senators, get behind anyone you can, anyone that'll listen, anyone that'll have any power at all, and force them to filibuster, this guy Alito. I mean, if Democrats don't think get together and do everything they can to stop the confirmation of Samuel Alito, Republican judicial henchman from the Third Circuit Court of Appeals in Philly, from becoming a Supreme Court justice, we're done. We're toast. This guy's everything that is bad about the right. This guy should have been gift-wrapped and given to the Christo-fascist zombie brigade by President Bush. I mean, look at this guy's record, Riley. It's disgusting.
Well, look, you're talking now about somewhere on the order of 8 senators who are going to, in the end, decide whether this guy goes up or down.
Yeah.
You've got 5 Democrats who are facing re-election in states where George W. Bush had a majority. Mm-hmm. That's next year.
Yeah.
They're facing re-election. They include Bill Nelson of Florida, Ben Nelson of Nebraska, Jeff Bingaman of your home state of New Mexico, Kent Conrad of North Dakota, and Robert Byrd of West Virginia.
Yeah.
They're going to come under tremendous pressure to confirm this guy, because they may face an enraged electorate, at least that's how it's going to be put to them, if they don't get on board with this. Now, there are also 3 Republicans, 3 New England Republicans, 3 pro-choice Republicans, who are also going to have a big role to play here. Olympia Snowe in Maine, Susan Collins in Maine, and Lincoln Chafee in Rhode Island.
So you tell me, Riley, that the stage is set for a filibuster. Is that what you're telling me?
What I'm telling you is, either it will be a filibuster, or some of those Republican senators may bolt. If enough do bolt and the Democrats hold firm, then the filibuster may not necessarily matter.
All right. Well, that's depressing, because this is a guy that would certainly seek to overturn Roe v. Wade. This is a guy who supports institutionalized racism. This is a guy that he is everything that we hate as liberals, as progressives. And I don't even know what to say about this, because I feel that there's a certain amount of doom involved in this. But you believe that we can fight this? Is there any hope, Riley?
Oh, yeah, there's hope. There's hope. If everyone in the Democratic Party holds their position, remember, 22 Democrats in the United States Senate voted for John Roberts. Can't afford it this time with Alito. They're going to have to stand firm, all of them.
Okay. Well, then, I got to tell you, I'm a little skeptical, Riley. I mean, I'd like to believe that that's possible, and I hope that it is, but man.
It's possible. This is politics. Anything's possible.
Yeah,
Will it happen? I don't know. It's certainly possible.
Is it possible that Freddie Ferrer will beat Michael Bloomberg?
Sure.
Really?
Absolutely. Let me tell you something. People were laughing at Michael Bloomberg 4 years ago, not that far out.
All right. Here's what we're doing. Here's what the president's doing. Now, keep in mind, folks, that some of the things we're not hearing about is that, the continued news, maybe there isn't news yet, but you have to understand Bill Frist is still under investigation by the SEC for insider trading. Tom DeLay is still under indictment in Texas, all right, on conspiracy and money laundering. Jack Abramoff, who's connected to God knows how many congressmen, is at the center of a federal investigation. Yesterday in Iraq, or the last month in Iraq, was about the bloodiest month for American troops since January. The U.S. military death toll for October is 92. The highest monthly total since January, when 106 American service members were killed. This is what's going on right behind the president. This is what's going on to him in his own house. Scooter Libby was indicted on 5 counts. Cheney is shameless, evil bastard Dick Cheney is. Let me tell you something. This guy has got colossal stones. What an arrogant putz. And putz is, that is a little word to use for as big a putz as this guy. We're going to talk about that in just a second. But here's what Bush is doing. Bush is heading to the National Institute of Health today to announce his strategy against the possible oncoming flu pandemic, my friends.
Yes.
It is thought to include the military corralling all those infected into camps and shooting them. No, I'm just kidding. All right, that's a little extreme. We know he's going to ask passed Congress for a bunch of money, and it's not just for a vaccine. There's been talk about engaging the military in public safety in the aftermath of disease outbreak by imposing martial law or overseeing quarantining, the quarantining of towns. I mean, I just see it, Riley, and maybe I'm wrong. This could be the new terror threat. I mean, how hard would it be for them to fabricate a case of bird flu, shut down Chicago, shut down L.A., shut down New York City? I mean, just wait till the new propaganda pitch. You're either with us or you're with the virus.
Well, yeah, and you're talking now about something, obviously, when you're talking about a bird flu or any kind of flu pandemic, you scare the bejesus out of the American people, just like when you raise a terror alert. There's really no difference.
The panic is going to be even more widespread, because now people are going to be looking around at the sweating guy next to him. I mean, I'm feeling a little under the weather. I thought I had bird flu 2 weeks ago. You know, in reality, I mean, I guess the reality is they're stockpiling drugs and vaccines. The vaccines are being churned out. There are two big drug companies. They got a contract for about $162.5 million to provide enough vaccine for the wealthy. The poor will adapt eventually and get stronger and stronger until the real revolution of the proletariat can happen.
Well, I'll tell you what.
Sorry, I digress.
Ask yourself this question when you talk about bird flu.
Yeah.
Guess how many pigeons there are in New York?
The last I counted, Riley, interesting.
5.5 million pigeons.
Really?
Yes.
Because when I counted 2 weeks ago, I got 4.9.
No, it's 5.5, trust me. 5.5 million. If you want to talk about something that can transmit bird flu to 8 million people real fast,
yeah,
talk about 5.5 million pigeons.
Speaking about pigeons, I had a tasty fillet of the pigeon of the sea, bluefish, care of Marino and Marino and Sons fishmongers. That's what I call bluefish. But it's, when it's fresh, it's terrific. Look, speaking about, is there any segue? Fish? Nah. Yeah, look.
Sure.
Scooter Libby is heading to court. We're going to talk about that in a second. We're going to talk about the shameless, you know, crown prince of the neocon death cult, Dick Cheney, and, you know, just who he nominated, or not nominated, who he replaced Libby with. Took two guys, and both of them evil. We'll get into that in a second. 17 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
This is Wayne Gilman, better known to the hard body mamas of the greater New York metropolitan area as Newsday. But I'm not busting a cap in some jive cat's ass for hogging the printer when I'm on deadline. I'm having a funky good time with Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Ooh, Newsday.
Well, look who's awake. Ready for another taste of Wayne?
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, it's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hey,
these are the last days, my friend, of Morning Sedition. We got a month long window on my occupying of this seat. Morning Sedition will return to O'Neill's Restaurant for our last live broadcast. This is Thursday, folks. We usually do these on Friday, all right? But it's Thursday, November 3rd. That's this week. O'Neill's, you know, it's great. It's great. It's a big place. The stage situation is great. It's got a lot of interesting paintings there. He usually puts out a little lox and put out rolls and bagels on the table, free coffee. We had a great time when we were there last time.
Absolutely.
We got Lisa Lampanelli, who is a dirty, crass comedian, who I like most of the time. And we have James Walcott, of course, you know, the columnist for Vanity Fair. I hear rumors that Mark Crispin Miller is going to come down and change the face of culture.
Uh-oh.
Mark Crispin Miller, in a departure for Mark, has told me, I ran into him yesterday down the village, down Houston Street. We were both at the same glasses place, looking at each other's round glasses, going, is this how it looks to get old and be a Jew? Well, okay, look. So I said to Miller, I said, look, you know, we'll have you on if you promise not to suck us into a black hole of despair. I said that. I said it right out. I said, you can only come on if you guarantee me that what you'll say will change the face of culture. And he said, yes, the iron is hot. It is time to strike.
Uh-oh.
That's a promise from Mark Crispin Miller there, folks. That's a promise. Now, that is going to be the last Morning Sedition live broadcast. Again, people, want to thank you for the hundreds of emails of support. Maybe they will do something. There is still politics going on here at the office, but you know, it's going to be difficult to fight a unilateral decision being made by the CEO here. Now, look, folks, talking about big politics, on Thursday, I. Lewis Scooter Libby will be arraigned on criminal charges. Let me repeat that. Criminal charges, 2 counts of perjury, 2 counts of lying to federal investigators, and 1 count of obstruction. If convicted of all 5, he faces 30 years in prison. He is expected to plead not guilty. No kidding. I guess that all depends, Mark, on whether or not he can recall what his plea will be, given that his only real defense is that he can't recall the sequence of events, which is why his story is so stupid and screwy. This is the guy that was Dick Cheney's go-to guy on everything. Dick Cheney, the most secretive, evil, manipulative politicker ever for that guy to trust this guy, Libby, to watch his back. You really think there's anything that Libby can't remember? You really think? Come on.
Let me tell you something. First of all, in addition to all of, you know, his duties, because he had 2 titles with Cheney, he had a 3rd title, which was advisor to the president. So I don't know how anyone can think, first of all, that Dick Cheney and George W. Bush let Scooter Libby kind of freelance his way through the whole plane leak thing. That's number one.
Oh, no.
That's impossible. Number two, you're right. A guy as calculating as Scooter Libby, and I'm not just saying this. You can look at his recent record or go back to 2003 and look at the sequence of events, who he met with, who he talked to. We'll get into that a little bit more in a second. And you realize he's a very, very calculating man. So if he has a loss of memory, my guess would be it's calculated.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the guys he picked to replace, it took 2 guys to replace Scooter Libby, right? The arrogance and the evil of Dick Cheney, let me tell you something, it knows no bounds, people. In a vacuum that lasted all of 3 days, okay, he rushed to replace his indicted chief of staff, Scooter Libby, with an equally dubious and perhaps equally indictable David Addington as his new chief of staff. He also appointed John Hanna to the National Security Advisor.
Heard that name before.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We thought he was the leaker. I mean, not the leaker for the plane case. We thought he was a guy that flipped and was giving the investigators some information. That, so much for inside lines.
Yeah.
Let me tell you something. With all the stuff that we got about, you know, this source said this source said that, you know, some of it may turn out to be true eventually, but clearly, if Dick Cheney is hiring John Hanna to be his national security advisor, that guy had not flipped.
No, but, you know, this guy Addington is a very interesting character in that...
He's dirty.
Well, he's dirty, yeah. But he's interesting as well because he and Cheney and Libby kind of formed this triangle of death in terms of executive power.
Right.
In terms of wanting unfettered executive power, which, of course, flows through the vice presidency as well.
Let's explain that in a minute, Mark. You know, I also want to do a reading of Scooter Libby's erotic prose poetry.
Oh, no. Can our hearts stand it?
Yeah, I can. He's actually a better writer than O'Reilly. let's explain what's going on with this guy Addington in a second. 27 past Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Before past the hour, it's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. For now, I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hey!
Look, folks, come on down Thursday to O'Neill's. It's up on 3rd and, you know,
no, 64th and Broadway.
November 3rd, 64th and Broadway, Thursday morning, folks, for our last live broadcast. It should be fun, should be touching. Let's get into this. Now, as I said before, Dick Cheney has named David Addington as his chief of staff. David Addington was once was Cheney's counsel, and John Hanna, who has been named National Security Advisor for the Vice President, was a Deputy National Security Advisor for the President, but for the Vice President. But let's get down to nuts and bolts here. This guy, David Addington, is as dirty as Libby. He's as dirty as Cheney. He's as dirty as all of them, and it just shows such arrogance on behalf of this Vice President. What did you expect? He's not going to apologize. I mean, literally, he was heralding Libby as one of the great Americans, you know, after he got indicted. These guys are criminals. Now, Addington is as dirty as Libby. He's up to his neck in the leak scandal and the attempt to manipulate intelligence and the American people around the Iraq war. This guy attended detailed strategy sessions with Libby and Cheney about how they could discredit Joe Wilson. He talked at those sessions about plans to release information selectively to Congress that would discredit Wilson. He worked with Libby and Cheney to shield themselves from the criticism coming from Congress of questionable intelligence, or lies, as we call them, used to justify the Iraq war. And according to some sources, Riley, Addington actually released information to damage Wilson, and he withheld information that would characterize the administration in an unfavorable light. Look, if Libby goes to trial, we're going to learn more about this guy Addington, because he's a criminal.
Well, Addington has played a very interesting role as counsel to Vice President Dick Cheney.
Uh-huh.
You may remember back during the transition between the Clinton and Bush administrations, when there was some question about who Dick Cheney called together to have discussions about energy policy in the incoming Bush administration.
Right, that was that secret meeting that everybody tried to figure out what the hell was going
on. Well, guess who helped keep it secret? David Addington.
Dirty
when
bastard.
When Congress started asking for minutes of the meeting, David Addington was the one that said, no, you cannot have it. When it came to notes from Scooter Libby's office that the Senate Intelligence Committee wanted as recently as last year, who stopped them? David Addington.
So he's basically one of these guys. He's part of the firewall that protects the devil. He's part of the firewall that protects Cheney. And he's also done some bidding on his own, apparently. Apparently, after Libby leaked the name of Plame to a couple of reporters, Addington was the first guy he went to and said, we got more on this guy Wilson. What can we get on Wilson?
Well, yeah, that's because Libby, according to Judith Miller, promised more information. And he went to David Addington to get that information within hours of that meeting on July 8, 2003, between Miller and Scooter Libby. Libby met with Addington and then came back and met with Miller subsequent to that time.
Okay, well, let's talk about another side of Scooter Libby. Having just read some bits and pieces of Scooter Libby's work, I'm looking forward to his jailhouse novel.
Work.
Yes, his jailhouse book of poetry. We all remember the cryptic yet classic closing prose poetry of the letter he sent to Judith Miller in prison. I'm going to read it as a haiku if I could. Out west, where you vacation, the aspens will already be turning. They turn in clusters because their roots connect them. Come back to work and life. Now, very touching stuff. Cryptic, weird. I don't know what the hell it means. But what we don't know, and, you know, I had to get this. I was reading The New Yorker, and this guy in The New Yorker did this big piece on these sections of this novel, that Scooter Libby wrote a pretty racy novel, right? And he's right up there with, you know, right-wing politicos, fascists, and criminals as having a lyrically sordid prose style. He can go the distance with Bill O'Reilly, Lynn Cheney, of course, G. Gordon Liddy, John Ehrlichman, Bill Buckley, you know, William Buckley, right? William Buckley. Yeah, all of whom have penned novels, but Scooter is dirty and weird and for reals, folks. I mean, this dude. I mean, now let me give you a little taste of O'Reilly. Can I get that?
Stripping off her bathing suit, she walked into the huge shower. She pulled the lime green curtain across the entrance and then set the water for a tepid 75 degrees. The spray felt great against her skin as she ducked her head underneath the nozzle.
Wow, that's
closing
hot.
Her eyes, she concentrated on the tingling sensation of water flowing against her body.
What is?
Suddenly, another sensation intruded. Ashley felt two large hands wrap themselves around her breasts and hot breath on the back of her neck. She opened her eyes wide and giggled. I thought you drowned out there, Snorkel Man.
Oh, Tommy O'Malley was Snorkel naked, Man.
And what, drowning is not an option, he said. He
could be reading
course,
news copy.
Begged me to perform unnatural acts right here in this show.
He calls him unnatural acts in his book.
Wow.
Did you hear that the guy, the hero's name was Tom O'Malley?
Yeah, oh, that's a stretch. Who could he be talking about?
Who wrote that? News Daddy?
Yeah, right. Yeah, Bill O'Reilly, that's an expert from those who trespass.
Say, baby, put down that pipe and get my pipe up.
What? Just the way he reads it, there's not a sexual bone in that guy's body that is in any way... delicate.
That's all for tonight, but if you want to learn more about Thailand, I'm available next Saturday.
Yeah, we all know about Thailand. If you want to know more about pedophilia junkets to Thailand, we got some information about that. But look, Scooter Libby actually really set out to write something lyrical and poetic, and these are fragments I got out of this New Yorker piece. The book is set in Japanese province in 1903. It has themes like incense, bestiality, homoeroticism. It is rich, my friends, okay? Apparently, the main female character in one scene actually draws hair
on the quote-unquote mound of a little girl. This is Scooter Libby. Hey, I'm not making this up. Scooter Libby, all right?
Oh,
Scooter Libby, the guy who is the advisor, chief advisor to the vice president of the United States. And I'm not knocking artists.
It's just a novel.
Yeah, I don't want to knock artists, but, you know, the brothers, listen to this, in one
artists.
Scene, the brothers of a dead samurai have sex with his daughter, all right? And look, okay, this is the
hey,
killer.
Hey, that doesn't happen in real life?
Dude, there's a dwarf. There's a dwarf in the book, all right? There's a dwarf.
Hey,
right.
I've seen that in movies before.
Of course you have. What kind of movies? Exactly.
Where the dwarf uses a stepladder.
All right, see, exactly, right? Here are some bits. Can I read a couple pieces from this? And I don't even know what their context is. oh, man. This is Scooter Libby from his novel, The Apprentice. Quote, at length, he walked around to the deer's head, and, reaching into his pants, struggled for a moment and then pulled out his penis. He began to, I'm going to have to use another word, pee in the snow just in front of the deer's nostrils. End quote. That's
Don't worry, I'm almost finished.
Yeah, there you go.
Stay relaxed.
Here's another piece from Scooter Libby's insane prose. Quote, he could feel her heart beneath his hands. He moved his hand slowly, lower still, and she arched her back to help him, and her lower leg came against his. He held her breasts in his hands. Oddly, he thought, the lower one might be larger. One of her breasts now hung loosely in his hand near his face, and he knew not how best to touch her. End quote. Okay, now here's where it gets weird. All right, first of all, if
he knew not.
Well, yeah, he knew not, and apparently, but he did know. He
was he Billy Shakespeare?
Yeah, he was doing some. He was doing some weighing of the breasts. You know, instead of actually being excited to be in an intimate moment, he was like, "Wow, this one's a little bigger." All right, quote. Here's another. Here's another piece. At age 10, the madam put the child in a cage with a bear trained to couple with young girls so the girls would be frigid and not fall in love with their patrons. They fed her through the bars and aroused the bear with a stick when it seemed to lose interest. Ooh. And then there's a scene where apparently something's going on because I just have this quote. He asked if they should the deer. A deer, like a deer. So, and apparently they do. I don't know if the deer is alive or not when they it, but, you know, look, this is Scooter Libby. This is his work. Now, what I want to know, bottom line is, what is it with these right-wing people that have written novels? I mean, where does it come from? Why have neocons and their wives, you know, killed the artist inside me, aside from these artists suck? You know, and then gone on to support and create such inhuman policy, you know, such horrendous, unfair, inhumane policy in terms of the future world. Is this all about the same type of bitterness that the bitterness of a failed painter that fueled Hitler? I mean, is it the hatred of the sensitive, soft self? I mean, just because your artistic dreams don't pan out doesn't mean you have to end the world or hurt everybody else. I don't understand it because there is a theme here, Riley.
Well, I think it's the other way around. I think that their rather stilted prose comes as a result of their access and reveling in power. I think that they figure, look, you know, I can press a button, blow up the world. I can do anything. So let me write.
Oh, really? So you think it's like, I can try this. Who's going to tell me I suck?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, but that's certainly the other side. But I have to think that, like, as somebody who has written my share of poetry in college, you know, we all have our periods.
Oh, me too.
Yeah, I mean,
there was a young man from Nantucket.
No, I never wrote those. I actually thought
it's through Andrew Dice Clay.
Yeah, right. I actually thought at some point when I was a student in English at Boston University that poetry was a viable job for me, that I would be a poet. You know, I was a big fan of the Beats. I was a big fan of Yeats and Shelley and whatever. You know, it's ridiculous. But if I were to sit here and pull out my poetry, I would find it embarrassing. But I knew better. I said, well, if I can make jokes instead of poems, I'd be all right. Then I'm still kind of being a poet. But, I mean, I think that these guys are like, they obviously hate the part of themselves now that creates this stuff. Though Scooter Libby, maybe not so much. I'm telling you, there's going to be a jailhouse novel.
Say, baby, put down that pipe and get my pipe up.
Yeah, now O'Reilly, I think, might be part of your theory because he doesn't make any attempt to hide his tone, to hide his crass, sexist disposition, to hide his insensitivity toward women in his prose style. So I think that he did feel entitled, like you were saying, Riley, to go ahead and write because of his position.
And this is a moron who actually has problems with rap lyrics?
Yeah, exactly. But I think that people like Scooter Libby, like Lynn Cheney, I think that they really had literary aspirations and took certain chances in certainly the sexual nature of what they were writing, and they realized they sucked, and so they decided to take it out on us.
Look, did somebody seriously think someone's going to get aroused, you know, listening or reading to the stuff that O'Reilly or Scooter Libby or Lynn Cheney or John Ehrlichman or Bill Buck? I mean, the list goes on and on.
I think they thought they were good. I think Scooter Libby thought he was gifted. I think he wrote this stuff.
Buckley knows he's gifted.
Yeah, gifted at what?
Well,
bloviating, going on and on in a nasal. But he's written some spy novels. I'm not going to say anything good about these people because it's not my job. All right, look, in a few minutes, we're going to talk to Nancy Keenan. She's president of NARAL. Pro-Choice America joins us on the phone to discuss the Samuel Alito nomination to the Supreme Court. So we'll get that angle. It's an important angle to hear. It is the angle. I have a couple other questions I want to talk to her about in terms of the Democratic stand. The Democrats stand on abortion. Are we giving it up as an issue in order to engage in the broader issue? I think it's a conversation to be had. So Nancy Keenan, president of NARAL, in just a few minutes. It's 46 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blog. MorningSedition.com, Air America Radio.
Fifty past the hour, it's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. For now, I'm Mark Maron, that's Mark Riley.
Hey!
Thanks for listening, folks. Thanks for all the great emails. We're getting emails from around the world. I'll talk a little more in depth about what's going on a little later. Not surprisingly, NARAL Pro-Choice America isn't too pleased with the nomination of Samuel Alito to the Supreme Court. NARAL President Nancy Keenan joins us on the phone to tell us why and what NARAL is planning to do to fight this nomination. Nancy Keenan, many thanks for joining us here this morning. How are we going to do it? What are we going to do? How can we stop this?
Well, thanks for having me on, Mark. Hey, listen, you know, 65% of the American public are pro-choice.
Yep.
And their voices, I think, are going to ring loud and clear.
Mm-hmm.
This president caved to the right wing, and we know that this is the O'Connor seat. And so whether it's online or on the ground or in the states, we're going to make darn sure that this president and the senators here, that he is not the right fit for the O'Connor seat.
Well, Nancy Keenan, I mean, what can we do here? You know, we knew, you know, when Bush got in office that this was going to be a possibility. I mean, what are our options? You know, who's better?
Well, you know, who's better? I think that he had an opportunity to bring the country together and choose a moderate, actually talk across the aisle to the Democrats with a few names that they had thrown out. But that's not the case. And so we have what we have today, and I think it behooves us to be calling some of those swing senators, Snow, Collins, Chafee, I think Warner, Specter and McCain. I think we've got to call Smith in Oregon. There's a lot of these moderates that we've got to pull along with the hopefully majority of Democrats and a few of those red state Democrats. Mm. We've got to pull them along. And, you know, yesterday I was standing outside of Rosa Parks service, and it struck me one person can make a difference, and picking up that phone, calling those senators, putting some pressure on it can make a difference.
Okay.
Now, Nancy Keenan, 15 years ago, when Samuel Alito was confirmed to the Third Circuit, Ted Kennedy praised him. Now Ted Kennedy is against his elevation to the Supreme Court. Aren't conservatives going to make hay with something like that, with that kind of perceived inconsistency?
Well, I think, you know, they're going to try. But as Senator Kennedy has said, that was 15 years ago. We now have 15 years of a record, 15 years that human rights and civil rights and women's rights have been attacked by this guy. And I really do believe that Americans, they believe in freedom. They believe in the right to privacy. And even Senator Kennedy say we now have a record to look at where this guy has not protected those freedoms.
Our guest is NARAL President Nancy Keenan. Now, Nancy, okay, would it be better if we were dealing with Harriet Myers in your eyes?
Well, hey, we did not oppose Harriet Myers right out of the box at all.
Well, we wanted to see them crash and burn on their own.
A little bit of that going on. It was a bit fun to watch.
Yeah.
But absolutely, I mean, there was the difference. She did not have a record, and yet that the administration would also not release any record. So we were kind of in a black box there and trying to figure out here who was Harriet Myers.
Yeah.
Nancy Keenan, 22 Democratic senators went for John Roberts. Mm-hmm. Which ones do you think are most likely to go with Samuel Alito at this point, because those are the people, obviously, that folks are going to have to target.
Right. And, you know, we're concerned about some of our red state Democrats. And
Ken Conrad, for example?
Some of the Mary Landrews, the Nelsons, you know, some of those folks that were part of the Gang of 14. And we are concerned. It's a very different day with regard to that group of 14, that Gang of 14, and the power, in essence, of that they hold, and especially if there is a filibuster and the whole nuclear option possibility that the Republicans will push forward. So this is watching a three-dimensional chess game. It is an unbelievable time in our history.
NARAL President Nancy Keenan is our guest. Well, look, you know, I've been reading some stuff that there's some Democratic thinkers, some Democrats that are thinking that maybe we should get this issue off the table. Maybe the abortion issue is it just drains from the actual political dialogue that could be building, you know, a broader platform for the Democratic Party. How do you answer that?
Look, this is not just about the issue of abortion.
Right.
And that's how the right wing wants to paint it.
Mm-hmm.
When we are pro-choice in this country, we value a lot of things. We value that young people should have access to accurate, medically appropriate sex education, and you should not mislead young people. It means in this country, and this is a hypocrisy, where you should have access to birth control and an equity in insurance and birth control, where
right.
These guys are also against that. The morning after pill, think of how long we have been holding that up over at the FDA, where we could prevent unintended pregnancies in this country, thus reducing the numbers of abortions.
Nancy, my wife just went out and bought some just because she wanted to do it while she still could.
Yeah, well, you know, that's the point. We have pharmacies refusing birth control prescriptions to women, so this is not just about the issue of abortion care. This is about women's reproductive health and these folks wanting to control all of it. Invade our privacy as women and our families, and absolutely, you know, they should join us. If you want to prevent unintended pregnancies, we can indeed reduce the numbers of abortions in this country.
Okay, so what do you think is going to happen with Alito, really?
Well, you know, it's going to be a long haul. I think the Republican majority right now and the president is pushing for a hurried up hearing process, and
yeah.
I think, you know, we have to move slowly. I think they know that on the docket in November is a case that is addressing the whole issue of whether or not the health exception should be retained
mm-hmm.
as part of Roe. And so they're going to hurry it up. I think we're going to mobilize our 800,000 online activists. We've
Great.
Got 27 affiliates and folks out there working every day on the ground.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for joining with us, you know, Nancy Keenan. I just, you know, I feel a little hope. Thank you.
Hey, there is hope.
Okay, good. You take care.
Thanks, Nancy.
That was Nancy Keenan, president of NARAL Pro-Choice America, with a reaction to the Alito nomination, which we'll talk about more in a few minutes. I'll give you a little more information about my status here and what I know about the status of the show. We've also got great guests coming up. We got Richard Branson, and we've got Chris Elliott later in the show. I haven't seen him in a while. 57 Past, Morning Sedition on Air America. America Radio.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Go. There's two of those. 6 past the hour. It's Morning Sedition for now here on Air America Radio. I'm Mark Maron. That's my friend Mark Riley.
Hey.
Thanks for coming down. Thanks for hanging out. We're going to do the Liberal Confessional here in just a minute. Folks, I just want to say before I get started here in terms of news and whatnot that Morning Sedition will return to O'Neill's Restaurant for our last live broadcast. That's Thursday. This Thursday, not Friday. Thursday, November 3rd at O'Neill's. That's on West 64th Street between Broadway and Central Park West. We're going to have a good time. It is our last live show. It is a big room, so feel free to come down. If you think it's going to be too crowded, come down anyways. We're going to have Lisa Lampanelli. That should be interesting and dirty and confrontational a little bit. Yeah. We're going to have James Walcott, who, of course, columnist for Vanity Fair, will maybe discuss the impact of what the airwaves would look like without me on Morning Sedition in the future, because he is a media critic. Also, we're going to have Mark Crispin Miller, who has promised me face-to-face, right to my face, Riley. He said, I'm not going to suck the show into a hole. I'm going to provide hope and the ideas for cultural change. He's just written a book about electoral fraud. He's a dear friend of mine. I love Mark Crispin Miller. And he's going to be on Thursday, and he's not going to make us depressed. Now, a lot of you, look, I cannot believe the outpouring of emails from around the world in response to my telling you the truth. I'm trying to be truthful with my listeners because I don't like holding this stuff in. You know, a few weeks ago, I told you that my contract was up for re-upping. You know, I was in a contract with Air America. It was for a year with a second-year option. That's the way it worked. Now, when it came, I alerted you guys that I didn't know what was going to happen because I've known there's one person, the person who can, the person who will, that make changes to this network, who was not a huge fan of the show. He wanted to get rid of the show, you know, for months now. You know, and he's been told by certain people that it's not a good idea. You know, one of them being Tim Robbins, who happens to love the show, apparently. Susan Sarandon. Brendan, you ran into Susan Sarandon. Susan Sarandon at a coffee shop said, you know, I'm not dropping names here, but it's nice to get some feedback from some stars, especially when that's important to somebody who makes decisions here. Now, look. I am just baffled and amazed and excited by, I mean, literally, we're getting emails from Alaska, from Sweden, from Switzerland, from Japan, from Thailand. But I got to be honest with you, the guy who can make these decisions does not care about podcasting, does not care about what the affiliates are doing. All he cares about are these New York numbers here. Now, the New York numbers were good. We are growing. But apparently, according to him, not quick enough for him, not quick enough for him to invest in me for another year. So that's what's going on. I've been told that my contract will not be renewed. I don't know how long I'll be on the air. I'm going to try not to speak my mind too much in a way that would get me pushed off before the end of the month. But who the hell knows what could happen here? And the bottom line is, I'm disappointed, folks. We built this show out of nothing. You know, we built this show with very little guidance. We built this show with a bunch of creative guys who I've grown to love over the last year and a half. I have a great relationship with my co-host, and we have a great thing going on here. And I've never heard anything like it on radio. And that's the bottom line. And the fact that I am being denied the opportunity to continue this growth and to continue this creative excitement every morning. I look forward to coming to work in the middle of the night. I really do. And that's amazing for me because for most of my life, I just wanted to sleep in. I look forward to coming here and doing this, no matter how aggravating it is, no matter how much homework I have to do. And the bottom line is I'm pissed off because, you know, Howard Stern is going off the air. All right, and just on a political level, and talking about bringing new people, not into the radio station, but there's a lot of progressive people out there about to happen. A lot of young people that don't know they're progressive. They just know they like boobs, and they like hearing people talk about boobs. But that's just a stone's throw away from getting their brains wrapped around the type of politics that this show can service. We service all kinds of people out there. I'm getting emails from 50-year-old people. I'm getting emails from 15-year-old people. I'm getting emails all over the world of people saying that liberals have to have a sense of humor, that even if they don't agree with this show, a sense of humor is imperative in not allowing ourselves to get so self-righteous and so self-glorified or narrow-minded around what we're really trying to do here. Now, someone has made a decision almost unilaterally to deny us the opportunity to speak to what could be potentially thousands and thousands of new voters that we could bring into this show because we've made a show that applies to everybody. It appeals to everybody because it's funny. All right, and funny for some reason is just not important to some of the people at this network. Very few. One. All right, funny is not that important. All right, I'm not sure what is important, but that's where I'm at. You know, I don't know when he's going to pull the plug on me. I don't know what's going to happen, but I love this show. I love doing it for you guys, and I'm saddened by the fact that we don't have an opportunity to compete in this market. Not just for success on this show, but to get this message to young people. Who could possibly be voters in the future, who possibly may not think about politics because it's too dry, too self-righteous, too condescending, too wonkish for them. We made this show for those people. And now, you know, I'm being, you know, denied the opportunity to carry that on. I've had look, I'm not saying that people aren't making offers, all right? I will show up somewhere else if that's the way my life is going to come. And I will certainly let somebody know, you know, where I am. But for now, I'm going to hold out. I'm going to keep doing this work. I'm going to see what happens here. You know, there's been talk of, keeping me on in some other capacity. So we'll see what happens. But that's the truth, all right? You guys wanted it. You got it. Okay, so now let's do something funny. All right, for those of you who are just tuning in, here's a few highlights of what we talked about on the program. It's time for today's Morning Sedition Cliff Notes. Scooter Libby is part of the grand tradition of Republicans who dabble in erotic fiction. Libby's plans to spend the next few years doing research for a new series of books on homosexual erotica, whether he wants to or not. It's a little jail joke. You know, we had to do it. Oh, it's the Pashman laugh. I miss that guy. Oh, man. All right. Okay, some people may get Libby's book, The Apprentice, confused with the television show, especially the end where someone is fired, packs their bags, and leaves in chains. Associates say in correspondence, Scooter will still lapse into blue language. In a letter last week, he said he'd been brutally Patricked and repeatedly Fitzgeralded. The trial over the legality of subway bag searches is underway in New York City. When asked if the bag search violated New Yorkers' privacy, one subway passenger said, quote, I just sat across from two girls comparing tattoos on their breasts, and the guy sitting next to me spent a half the trip talking about his hemorrhoid surgery. I don't think New Yorkers know what privacy is. End quote. A new study shows that most Australians consider getting drunk to be part of their national identity. Wow, Riley, all those years I was Australian and I didn't even know it. All right. Officials denied that Australia is a nation of drunks and said they have an abnormally high percentage of people that pee in the streets. That's all. Oh, look at that. It's so weird. All right. It's so interesting that laugh is so easily reproduced, and it makes me feel so elated inside, the Pashman laugh. I had no idea how much I relied on it in my head. I hope he's having fun in Slovakia. I hope it's safe there. I don't know why he hasn't called us. All right. Well, look. Let's talk a little bit about the news. We'll do a little local stuff first because we talked a little bit about this earlier. Bloomberg is overkilling. You know, he looks like a bully to me, Riley. He's got television ads in every language on the air here, every language. He's putting millions and millions of dollars now calling Freddie Ferrer a flip-flopper. Whatever you think of Ferrer, that's not the issue. The issue is you got a guy with a lot of money beating up on a little guy, and this is a little guy that wants to represent the little people. And somehow Bloomberg just, he cannot have any humility around this thing.
Well, I mean, he's spending up to $100 million to get reelected here. I think maybe, because Mike Bloomberg has some very, very smart people around him. In fact, smarter people than his fellow Republican George W. Bush. And I think that eventually those people, we only got a week left until the election here in New York, folks. Next Tuesday is when it all happens.
That's why we're talking about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it looks as though Mike Bloomberg is going to win in a walk. That's how it looks. You never know in electoral politics. You certainly never know in New York politics. Freddie Ferrer has certainly had nowhere near the kind of money that Bloomberg has had at his disposal to spend on trying to get his message out to the public. So it looks like Bloomberg is everywhere. I mean, he's got the messages and commercials and everything from Cantonese to Korean.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And it's almost annoying. But look, here, it is annoying. What do you mean, almost? I'm just trying to figure out what we're going to do in a couple minutes before we take a break here. Look, here's a couple of things that are going on. I, Lewis Scooter Libby, will be arraigned on criminal charges. Let me repeat that. Criminal charges, 2 counts of perjury, 2 counts of lying, one count of obstruction
of justice.
If convicted on all 5, he faces 30 years in prison. He's expected to plead not guilty. That's going to be on Thursday. Of course, Lewis Libby, if you don't know, I will tell you, was the vice president chief of staff who was indicted in the leak scandal. Now, on other news fronts, look. This last month has been the bloodiest month in Iraq since January. As you know, Bill Frist, the Senate Majority Leader, under investigation at the SEC. As you know, Tom DeLay, the dwarf king of the legislative pig pack of the neocon death cult, is been indicted on a couple of counts down in Texas. We know that this scandal has taken a tremendous toll on the White House. He's just nominated Samuel Alito, an insane judicial fascist, to the Supreme Court. And what is Bush doing? Well, today he's going over to the National Institute of Health to announce a strategy against the possibility of oncoming flu pandemic, the bird flu. He's going to scare the hell out of us in a different way, folks. Look out for the propaganda campaign. You're either with us or you're with the virus. So we'll get more into the news in just a second. We got Peter Guralnick coming, who's written a couple of great books about Elvis Presley. We just wrote a beautiful book about Sam Cooke. Looking forward to talking to him. Stay with us. It's 16 past the hour. It's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition.
Just to wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
21 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. I am Mark Maron. That is Mark Riley.
Hey.
This is our show. Thank you for listening to it. You've been great. Morning Sedition will return to O'Neill's Restaurant for our last live broadcast. That's Thursday, folks. Thursday, regulars. Thursday, November 3rd. I'm talking to Rich out there. Rich, two bagels. I'm talking to those two guys that always sit up front. Phyllis, I'm talking to you. Lynn, if you're planning on bringing some peppers and tomatoes, it's Thursday, all right? You hear me? Thursday at O'Neill's, November 3rd on 64th Street between Broadway and Central Park West for our last live broadcast. Looking forward to seeing you there. Sometimes, you know, when we read the headlines, it can be tough to figure out just exactly what the mainstream media is saying. So luckily we have an iNews 5000 Wi-Fi headline translator. Let's crank it up and give it some headlines. Here we go. From USA Today, Bush picks Alito. All right. Bush picks Alito for Supreme Court. Bush picks Alito for Supreme Court. Translation, mob boss chooses henchman. From ABC News. It's not a big laugher, I know. I don't expect laughs on that one.
What'd you call Alito yesterday, man? You said he looked like a sluggo.
A sluggo on the phone. He does. He looks like a, you know, just like an Italian sluggo guy. You know what I mean? He just he looks like, you know, if he was wearing a little cap or something, he could be a shoeshine guy or a guy who's on the street going, papers! You know, for some reason he reminded me of old Three Stooges movies. I don't know what it is. Maybe he looks like Moe a little bit. I don't know.
No, he would look like the guy that is angry at the Stooges.
Right, right. The guy's like, and then walks out of the room, and they go, and then it unfolds into the whole thing. Yeah, all right. Democrat urges, what, huh? From ABC News, Democrat urges Rove to quit over CIA leak. Democrat urges Rove to quit over CIA leak. Translation, Rove, guilty until proven guilty. From Iowa. From Iowa. Now, Brendan, you cannot use Dan's laugh to compensate for your lack of laughter. That is unfair. You can use it now, though. All right. From Ireland Online, Charles and Camilla attempt to win over U.S. All right. Charles and Camilla attempt to win over U.S. Translation, Prince Charles to U.S., die is dead, get over it. Is that the one I picked? I thought I picked another one. What happened to the other one? Dave, you know, wait, where's Dave? Put him on the mic. A little Goliath. Dude, what's going on with you, man?
I'll go fishing for it in the...
No, it's just like, you know...
Man, I'm pretty sure.
No, dude, what's the matter with you? What's going on with you, man? What's the problem?
I'm happy.
You're not happy. You walk in here, you're scrambling, you're on the verge of a breakdown.
I know, a big piece of pizza today that he walked in with.
He eats garlic knots and pizza every morning. I know these aren't your hours, dude, but please, you know, I mean, try and stay on top of it. You all right, though? You comfortable?
I'm good. I went to the Halloween parade thing, so I stayed out a little later than I usually do. So I'm a little.
Oh, so I know
flustered.
That feeling.
Yeah.
Sure, I know that feeling. You got like booze sweating out of your pores.
Well,
you're a little nauseous. Not sure what you did at the Halloween parade with the whatever it was dressed as Marilyn Monroe.
Oh my God!
I know what you're talking about, right? I understand.
Something
like that. You give me the wrong damn joke. All right, look, here we go. Let's talk about, you know, I guess we could talk about Rove for a second, but I wanted to also, I'm very excited to have Peter Guralnick on the show. This guy has written some monumental books about music, like a two-volume, huge tome, two tomes on Elvis Presley. He wrote a little book about Robert Johnson that I enjoyed, and this book's about Sam Cooke, who, interesting, my experience with somebody like Sam Cooke, Riley, obviously going to be different than yours. You're a little older than me.
I am.
Yeah, a little bit. But, like, I had one of these guys. I didn't understand what R&B was all about. I was, like, 14 or 15 years old. I was in high school. There was a guy that worked at the record store next to where I work at the bagel shop, the only bagel shop in Albuquerque, where they called me Bagel Boy, by the way. All right. But he worked in the record store, and he said, "You want to know about R&B?" And the guy took me to his house. Okay, this doesn't get sorted either. Took me to his house. The guy had thousands of records, sat there with me for like 5 hours, and made me a tape on a cassette of all the R&B that he thought was important. And some of that, you know, Sam and Dave, Ray Charles, you know, James Brown, Sam Cooke was one of them. So I had these four or five songs by Sam Cooke who I'd never heard of. And I'll tell you something, his voice and his words, as sweet and as pop as it was, were just perfect, transcendent. And I remember, I mean, Cupid is one of the greatest songs
I have ever heard.
Well, it's funny. I was not a big Sam Cooke fan as a kid because I liked music with a lot of drums and bass in it. And Sam Cooke's records, if you listen to across the panoply of his music, there's not that much of that. I came to become a big fan of his voice later in life when I actually sat and listened to the kind of stuff and listened to some of his gospel stuff, which is not widely released.
Well, he's one of those guys that was supposedly sort of brought gospel into the R&B fold with Ray Charles. I'm sure Goralnik will address some of that when we talk to him about that. But I just thought his voice was transcendent, and he had that ability to hit these notes that, not necessarily that they were that high, but they somehow were uniquely his.
Well, yeah, they were his, and he was part of a very large group of singers at that time, included Jackie Wilson, Lenny Welch, and a bunch of other guys who all had very, very distinctive voices.
Yeah.
And you know, were making decisions about how they were going to use them. And Sam Cooke was interesting also because he wanted to control his own destiny in a way that during the early 60s, during the height of the Civil Rights Movement, not many black artists had the opportunity to do.
Well, that sounds like an interesting conversation. I'm looking forward to talking to Mr. Peter Goralnik in just a few minutes about his new book. Also, folks, I hope you don't mind that we're going to talk a little bit about music. And I imagine that we're going to get into... there's an element to a civil rights discussion to have around Sam Cooke as well.
Oh, sure.
And also, you know, we are going to talk about the nomination of Alito, about Matthew Cooper, who he said actually gave him the leak first. We're going to get into that news as well. But after this, we're going to talk about Sam Cooke and about music, if that's all right with you. 27 past Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Darling, you sent me. Send me, darling, you.
34 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hi.
Our next guest has been described as the preeminent writer on American popular music of the 20th century, known for his seminal biography of Elvis Presley, Last Train to Memphis. He's turned his attention now to Sam Cooke. His latest book, Dream Boogie, The Triumph of Sam Cooke, took nearly 7 years to write. To tell us more about the man remembered for such masterpieces as A Change Is Gonna Come, Chain Gang, Wonderful World, this song we're listening to now, we're having a party. Peter Goralnik joins us live in the studio. Good morning, Peter.
Morning.
It's nice that you're here. I'm a big fan of your stuff. I love the book you wrote about Robert Johnson, a huge Robert Johnson fan, a huge blues fan. Was it the blues that brought you to Sam Cooke?
Blues took me everywhere. I mean, the blues woke me up to the music when I was about 15 years old.
Uh-huh.
A couple of years later, I realized, well, the blues isn't just something you listen to in your bedroom on your own little phonograph. It's alive out there. And then I started out going out to listen, and that led me within a year or so to ushering the rhythm and blues and soul shows that came to town. So I was just like this kid, a very scared kid, but ushering the shows. Worst usher in the world, but ushering the shows when Jackie Wilson, Solomon Burke, Otis Redding, Joe Tex came to town.
What was it, the one, which one just blew your mind? What was that moment where you're like, what is this?
They all blew my mind.
All right.
They were all different. Solomon Burke was the first show that I ever saw. He was headlining the Summer Shower of Stars in 1964, and Otis Redding and Joe Tex were both on the bill, and Garnett Mims and the Enchanters.
Garnett Mims and the Enchanters. From New Orleans.
Garnett Mims was, I don't know, he's out preaching in North Carolina now, I think.
Is he?
But Solomon was the star of the show, and he held the show. And right around that same time, I saw the James Brown Show for the first time, which to me was the greatest theater I've ever seen in my life.
Now let's turn the attention to Sam Cooke. Now, what about Sam Cooke and specifically prompted you to write this huge, beautiful book?
Well, what sold me on the music, what sold me on the music was the gospel music.
Yeah.
I heard the pop hits and, you know, was knocked out by them to a degree. I mean, and subsequently I've heard a lot more, but it was the gospel music that really put it over for me. But what started me on the book was I was working on sweet soul music, rhythm and blues, on the Southern Dream of Freedom in the early 80s.
Yeah.
And I met J.W. Alexander, Sam Cooke's friend and business partner, in 1982. And he painted a picture of Sam Cooke, who was, along with Ray Charles, was really the founder or the progenitor of that Southern gospel-based soul music. I met J.W. Alexander, and the portrait that he painted of Sam was so extensive. It was so wide-ranging. It showed a man who was so broad in his intellectual interests, so deeply committed to the civil rights movement, so determined not to be played by anyone, not to be disrespected, not to take scraps from anyone else's table, but to follow his own life, set up his own business, that from that point on, from 82 on, I knew I wanted to write a book on Sam Cooke, but it took about 15 years for me to get to the place where I could.
Let's talk a bit about Sam Cooke's drive, because he was at a time when most black people who would have tried to control their own production in music would have been thought of as either a megalomaniac or totally insane. He tried this and was, toward the end of his life, a little successful at it. What did you find drove him? You talked to his partner. What was it that made him want to buck that trend?
Well, I mean, it was the same thing that, gave rise to the Nation of Islam. It was what he grew up with coming from his father, who was a minister in the Church of Christ Holiness, which is kind of an offshoot of the Church of Christ, Church of God in Christ, Pentecostal sect. But it was the idea that, you don't let anyone set limits for you. You don't let anyone put you in a bag. I mean, Reverend Cooke went out on the street, told the white policeman, he said, "Don't you manhandle my boy. Don't you, don't you tell him what to do. I will discipline my children. You keep to your own business." So it was that kind of example. But it was meeting J.W. Alexander, who had set up his own publishing company as early as 1958, that educated or helped educate Sam in the one central fact of the music business, which is that ownership is everything.
Yeah.
And kids today should recognize that a hit is not where you're going to make your money. Writing the songs and owning the publishing on your songs, that's where you make your money. And
so much money. So much money.
Well, if you have a hit. I mean, if people record your songs, right.
Right. And now, is all that money still going into Sam Cooke's family? His wife is still alive?
It is. Yeah, I mean, the songwriting money. His wife sold off the publishing almost immediately after he died in what was somewhat a misguided business decision. I mean, she tried to capitalize on it. And the result was that she turned over most of the money to the government at the time in taxes. She did not follow his precepts.
Peter Guralnick, there's something about Sam Cooke's music and the way he lived his life that seems to be a common theme in many instances where you find people coming out of the black church. And that is, Sam Cooke, his father was a preacher. He started out in gospel music. But yet he, to put it mildly, dabbled in many secular concerns and pleasures. And we see this even now. I mean, with hip-hop music, where you have people that do albums with full of vulgarity, but the first thing they do when they win an award is thank God. What exactly was it about? How did he reconcile that?
Well, and thank their mother, too.
Oh, yeah, their mother. Their mother and God, not necessarily in that order.
No, I don't think there is any either reconciliation or contradiction. I mean, without sin, there's no salvation, and I think that's always been a tenet of the black church anyway. I simply have never met anyone out there on the road, black or white, sacred or secular, who has led a life very different from Sam Cooke. We can pretend that life is a fairy tale and that life should be this way or that way, but Sam had a very active social life from a very early age, and he maintained that, but to say he was not the exception in that respect. I have had a friend, her husband was a big star, and she says, "Peter, every one of them is the same." She said, "But I've got one. He's my shining light. He's my shining hope." And then she called me up a couple of years later. She says, "Peter, I got to tell you, he fell down."
Oh, yeah. Well, that's an interesting point you bring up, is that, I didn't grow up with Sam Cooke. I knew nothing about him. I told the story how I was came into Sam Cooke's music before you got on. Someone turned me on to him, when I was in high school. He's long dead. I didn't know anything about him. I knew he had this smooth voice. I knew his music didn't seem to take a lot of chances to my young ear, being that it had already been polluted by Zeppelin and the whatnot. and that all I knew was here was this clean-cut guy who sang these sweet songs, and he was killed in this sordid event. That's all I knew.
Right.
I'd seen a picture of the woman that shot him. I listened to his music, but that's really all I knew. So what you're doing here is you're bringing people a very broad, in honoring what you see as a broad personality and a guy who was incredibly active in so many ways, you're really filling in all the gaps. Is there any fear that you will break the myth for people that believe the myth of Sam Cooke?
I don't believe in myths, and I think we have to get beyond myths. We live in a consumerist society, and I think it misleads us in every way, including the political. We have to see the reality.
Good.
And there's nothing wrong with the reality. The picture pose, I wrote in the introduction to the book that A friend of mine, Lithophane Pridgen, who became much better known for her relationship with Jimi Hendrix, but she was good friends with Sam. And she said, I'm not interested in any white picket fence. She said, you know, at the time, she wasn't interested in any picture postcard view. I mean, one of the things she said to me, she said, I didn't want Sam or anybody else to take me up to heaven. If anything, I wanted to take them down to hell. But, I mean, she enjoyed...
What's her number?
She's a woman who enjoyed her life. And everybody I talked to for this book, yeah. All the people around Sam, and just a wide assortment of characters, great, great people, they enjoyed their lives. They are not looking back and they're saying, oh, I mean, they might say, well, I did that before I was married. And I
right.
understand that.
Yeah.
But the point is, they're not recanting on it. They're not saying, oh, I shouldn't have done that.
Right.
They had a heck of a time out there.
Yeah, that's great.
I'd like to take two situations at the end of his life. One, obviously, his death, because I think there's been a lot written and miswritten about how he died, why he died. And also his writing of A Change Is Going to Come, which was, I think, a seminal moment in
right.
what was a very all-too-brief career.
So which do you want to take first?
Let's take A Change Is Going to Come first, because that happened first, right?
Well, right, that's right.
And it happened before his death.
Yeah.
I mean, A Change Is Going to Come came from several specific events, but broadly speaking, it came from the Civil Rights Movement, from Sam's growing awareness of the Civil Rights Movement. He had acquired a library of black history long before black history was taught in the schools. He read Langston Hughes, he read James Baldwin, he read County Cullen, he read James Weldon Johnson. He read John Hope Franklin was his introduction to black history.
Okay.
So there was both the civil rights movement. There was the fact that J.W. Alexander gave him a copy of Freewheeling Bob Dylan, the album, in the summer of 64. Sam picked up on Blowing in the Wind, and he said, you know, I'm ashamed that a white boy wrote that. I should have written a song like that. And then in the fall of 60, I'm sorry, this is 63. This is right at the time of the March on Washington. And in the fall of 63, Sam was... arrested in Shreveport for refusing to be turned away from a segregated motel in Shreveport, Louisiana. He was thrown in jail, and that was a direct precipitator. And he wrote A Change Is Going to Come in the immediate aftermath of that. And in a way, it scared him because it came to him. He told J.W. Alexander it was as if it came to him in a dream. Yeah. And he just didn't know exactly where it came from. But in so many ways, it summarized what's so extraordinary about it is it summarized the movement. It was immediately adopted as a kind of anthem by the civil rights movement. But it has survived to this day because of Sam's genius as a songwriter, which allows him to take specific experience but cast it in an open-ended enough form so it can apply to many different things. Mm-hmm. So in the wake of Katrina, you heard people singing A Change Is Going to Come, and people could sing that song. I mean, there are a lot of people out there who says A Change Is Going to Come. A change has got to come. And that would come, you know, that, and Sam's song would represent that.
That's the magic. That's the magic of song. Well, now we got a few minutes. Let's get into the death.
Let's talk about his death.
Okay, I want to just stress that Sam's death was death by misadventure. It's a meaningless death. You mentioned it as a sordid thing. He was killed at a motel. He went there with a prostitute. She ran off with his clothes and money.
This was a common game.
This was her game. I've got the private investigator's report, which went into great detail about this woman, Elisa Boyer, and this was her modus operandi and the assumption behind it. And I honestly don't quite get this. The assumption is either that her, you know, client or John was too drunk or would be too embarrassed to go after her. Well, whether Sam was drunk or not, he was not too embarrassed
to go after her.
He took strong exception to being played in that manner. And he believed she had gone into the motel manager's apartment. He broke down the door, and eventually he got shot by the motel manager. Now, the point that I would make, though, is what's much more significant than his death. Is that it was something that simply could not be accepted in the black community at that time, and I would say to this day has never been accepted within the community. And the reason for it is because Sam was so much more than a star. He was a shining light.
Yeah.
He was somebody who was taken to be... as better than this.
A myth.
A myth, you're right. You're right. A myth, not a man. And someone who, in essence, he was so cool, he was so smooth. As Alan Toussaint said, he was hip, but not with a switchblade, with a comb. And he was just the hippest guy around. He could have any girl he wanted. He could have, you know, why would he be there? Why would he?
Right.
Well, in the book, I explain that this was not uncommon for Sam, including the fact that he had been to that motel. But what I think is really significant is that I could have filled 50 or 100 pages in the appendix with all the theories that I was given about how Sam died, the conspiracies that killed him.
Sure.
And they ran the gamut from the mob killing him to his body, to him, to his being killed in Beverly Hills. The body was moved to
really?
His cheap motel,
yeah.
to the Las Vegas, the Las Vegas mob killing him, because even though he never played Las Vegas, he said he wasn't going to play ball with them. But every single one of the theories revolves around the idea, around the central element, that this here was another proud black man who the white establishment was not going to let get any further. And that's an idea, that's a concept I can totally buy into and I can totally understand, and it proceeds from the blatant prejudice of the time, and it would be something that would not be incredible at this time. So as a concept, it makes perfect sense.
But in reality.
But none of the people who spoke to me and all of these, several of the theories had five or six different individuals close to Sam, or maybe four or five. They were the ones who killed him. Each different
right.
theory had a different person killing him. But the point is, there was no evidence to any of these theories, and in talking to the people who knew Sam best, not one of them doubted the circumstances of his death. And from reading the private investigator's report, the inquest, I think there are elements of it that could be questioned, but I think the central aspect of it is the way it happened.
All right, well, I'm glad that you cleared that up, and I tell you, this is a beautiful book. I want to appreciate you being here and talking to us about this. I learned something. The book is Dream Boogie, The Triumph of Sam Cooke. It's available now. Our guest has been Peter Goralnik. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, we'll be back with the Liberal Confessional. Here's a little Sam Cooke now. It's 48 past the hour.
It's lasted so long. Now I find myself wanting to marry you and take you home. I know, I know, I know. Send me, I know you. Send me, oh, oh. Send me, honest, you do.
Morning Tradition, Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
Don't just stare at it, eat it.
On Air America Radio.
Fifty-three past the hour, Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hey.
This is Morning Sedition for the time being. You're listening to Air America Radio. Peter Goralnik, who was just in here, the author of Dream Boogie, The Triumph of Sam Cooke, will be tonight at Barnes & Noble at 7 o'clock at 83rd and Broadway, and then tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the Schamburg Center for Research and Black Culture at 135th and Lenox. He's very excited, and he loves to talk, clearly. Hey, and informative. The guy knows what he's talking about. It's not easy being a liberal, Mark. We all stray from the straight and narrow from time to time, but when we need to unburden ourselves, we can always confess our liberal sins. If you want to take a turn in the liberal confessional, give us a call at 866-303-2270. That's 866-303-2270. But right now, it's my turn. Bless me, Brother Riley, for I've sinned.
How can I ease your burden, my son?
Well, look, as you know, they've told me I'm not going to be hosting the show anymore, though I may be involved in some way.
How was that a confessional?
Well, I could have told them that I would do the show for less money.
My son, don't be desperate. You deserve to be paid for what you do.
Yeah, but I feel like maybe if I'd offered, things would have gone differently. I don't know.
You put in a lot of hard work on this show, and I think you should be compensated for that.
Yeah, I know. But maybe I feel a little greedy now. You know, liberals aren't supposed to be greedy.
Liberals also believe in fair play.
Well, but for me... I mean, I should get paid more so I can, what, have a bunch of yuppie crap I don't really need? I don't know.
You can always give your money to charities, Mark. It's the principle that matters here.
Yeah, but shouldn't I be helping the liberal cause here? You know, walking it like I talk it, my friend?
Do you really think you could help out the liberal cause in this network by taking less money?
Probably.
Well, I think I know your penance, Mark. I want you to march right in there to management and tell them you'll take less money to keep doing this show.
Oh, I forgot to tell you something, Riley. They didn't even offer me that choice.
They didn't?
No.
Wow, man. So, Oh, my goodness. Sorry, man.
Yeah. Tell me about it.
Now go forth and sin no more.
Amen. Thank you, Brother Riley. Now, if anyone else out there wants to confess and seek absolution in our liberal confessional, you can give us a call right now at 866-303-2270. That's 866 303-222-7070. It's the cold, hard truth, my friend. You know what? Who's going to be on in a few minutes, Riley? We're going to take the confessions in just a second. We're going to log these confessions, these calls on our little screen here. Richard Branson.
Sir, yes, Sir Richard. Sir Richard Branson.
Yeah, maybe we can get him to buy the network. maybe we can get him to.
Does he have more money than Mike Bloomberg? I think he probably did.
I would hope
close.
So. Well, how much does Bloomberg have?
4.6, I think.
Yeah.
Give or take 100 mil.
Yeah, maybe. That's unbelievable.
Yes, it
you
is.
You know what I mean? It's weird. I'm going to get him on the phone. I'm going to have to stop myself. You know when you know people are that rich, doesn't there a party that just wants to go, dude, give me some money. Just give me some money.
Give me a plane.
Give me a plane. I'll take a plane.
Give me first-class tickets wherever I want to go for the rest of my life. Come on.
It's like that great Richard Pryor bit, you know, where he comes back home to where he grew up after he dirty.
Oh, yeah, Peoria. Yeah.
Right, right. And the guy, you're just still doing the same stuff you used to do around here. Give me a dollar. No. Just because you're you. Just give me a dollar.
Oh, my God.
All right, so we're going to be logging the confessions later in the show. As I said, we're going to have Richard Branson on here. We're also going to talk to Chris Elliott. Very funny guy.
He's crazy. He's crazy.
I haven't seen him around in a while. We're also going to get a little into the Alito thing. We'll talk a little bit about the leak scandal. I'll tell you a little bit more about what's going on here at Air America for me, or as much as I know. And that should be it. That should be the show. So we're logging confessions, 866-303-2270. It's 57 past the hour. You're listening to Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Blah, 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 blah.
6 past the hour. It's Morning Sedition for the time being. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hi.
You're listening to Air America Radio. We got the confession docket up here on the screen in front of me. We're taking confessions here in the Liberal Confessional. We will be talking about some of the news in a little bit, just a little while. Riley, you said something that made me very upset. You said that maybe this guy Alito might not be stoppable, and that scares me a little bit.
Well, he's going to be tough to stop all without right. A united group of Democratic legislators.
You hear that, Democratic?
Which I'm not sure we've put in office.
Oh, my God. All right, Robin in Florida, what's your confession, Robin?
Hey, Robin.
Hi.
Hi. Well,
first of all, I missed all the stuff on Friday because we didn't have power.
Uh-huh.
My confession is that I spent the week before the hurricane just feeling joy and glee and pleasure at the thought of the indictments that were coming the following Friday.
Right.
And I think myself and many other Floridians actually brought this hurricane upon ourselves.
Why? Because
so we could not watch TV. We couldn't hear Chris Matthews rehash. We couldn't hear anybody talk about it. We were incommunicado.
So how did you bring it on yourself? Just because you were...
It's joy. It's simple joy.
So what's the sin? What's the sin here, Robin?
My sin was such pleasure beyond belief to hear of the Bush woes.
Oh, that well here. Well, let me help you out. Lewis Scooter Libby will be arraigned on criminal charges on Thursday. 2 counts of perjury, 2 counts of lying to federal investigators, 1 count of obstruction. There's a possible conspiracy. You have done nothing wrong. This is not anything to feel bad about. It is not even Schadenfreude. It is justice, Robin. And you know, enjoy it.
All right, now can I tell you how we got our phone and how we got our power back? And this might help you with Morning Sedition.
Okay, quickly.
All right, very fast. I'm Jewish, and I was looking for, you know, long-lasting candles. Yahrzeit candles only last 24 hours.
Yahrzeit candles,
so
sure.
So I went for the Santa Maria candles. I lit 3 7-day candles. We got our phone back. I lit the last 2 20 minutes later. Our power came back.
Oh, my God.
This is my cure for everybody in Florida and to keep your job.
Okay. So light a Santa Maria candle. Okay, thank you.
No, at least five.
Oh, five.
All right, Robin.
I'll show you where the nearest Botanica is.
Thank you very much.
You have a great day, and I'm going to miss you if you're not here, and I hope you are.
Oh, thank you. I hope I am too, Robin. Thank you so
much.
Take care,
Robin.
How hilarious is that? The Yahrzeit candle, only 24 hours on that one. Santa Maria candles, five of them. She got everything back on. That's hilarious. We have to interrupt this confession. These confessions, stay on the line. We'll take them, but we've got our guest is on the phone. But as I said, we'll take the confessions in a minute. We're going to talk to him for a few minutes. Our next guest is a global entrepreneur taking on global poverty. That's good. It's about time. That's right. The man best known for daring publicity stunts, balloon rides, and pissing off British Airways is now involved in the fight against poverty worldwide. He's taking part in the Times Summit on Global Health, which starts today in New York City. Sir Richard Branson, chairman of the Virgin Group, joins us on the phone this morning. Good morning, Richard. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Are you in a balloon or skydiving right now?
Right now, I'm sitting in my bed of my mobile phone talking to you.
Okay, yeah, all right. There you go. Oh, good. So we got your full focus. Now, what do you mean? I read some of the press materials. Now, what do you mean when you say that global health is good business? What exactly you got going?
I'm not sure it's good business. I mean, I just got back from Africa where, the nightmare that is Africa, where just literally hundreds of thousands of
sure.
people dying of AIDS and
yeah.
malaria and other unnecessary things taking place. So it's a matter of trying to work out how we can maybe use our entrepreneurial skills or whatever to address these problems.
Oh, I see.
Not allow it to continue to happen.
Okay, so now, just tell me exactly some of the actions you're taking and what does this program look like that you're getting behind here?
Well, this week we've got together a lot of doctors from South Africa and Africa generally, entrepreneurs who are willing to put their hands in their pockets to and also come up with ideas of how to address the problem. I think that one thing that we're going to propose this week is that that we treat Africa as if it's a war, which it is. I mean, there are many, many, many more people dying in Africa than almost any war, and we tackle it like a war zone, and we have somebody in charge who's looking at what are the best battles that are taking place in particular countries, which are the best clinics, how we can take particular ideas from one clinic into another country.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, there's a wonderful clinic in South Africa where they've discovered that if you start giving mothers who HIV positive antiretroviral drugs when they're 20 weeks pregnant, that none of the children get HIV.
Wow.
Whereas no other hospital has actually realized that. So it's important to get that out. Get that information out to all the other hospitals. 99% of all hospitals in South Africa not giving people antiretroviral drugs, and therefore, they're hospitals where people go to die.
Oh, that's awful.
The handful that are giving antiretroviral drugs, almost everybody's going home, able to continue their lives. So it's just trying to confront Africa in a way that it hasn't really been confronted, I think, properly before.
Now, Sir Richard Branson, there are certain African countries where AIDS had certainly been a scourge, but they have managed through some innovative programs to cut the incidence of people becoming HIV positive and later contracting the disease. Is there a common thread that you see with these successful programs that can be replicated?
Well, I mean, there are some like Uganda that have done very well in getting out and educating people about the need to wear condoms, and that is definitely in the same way that in America the amount of people getting HIV because of condom use has dropped dramatically. The same has happened in Uganda, but in some countries it's almost too late. I mean, there's something like 35% of young people between the ages of 0.5% of Africans are actually getting the antiretroviral drugs. And so, we've got a massive campaign to make sure that that everybody can get them.
All right. Well, you're breaking up a little bit, Sir Richard Branson. I appreciate you doing what you can to raise awareness and to get money to people that need it, people who are suffering in Africa of AIDS and their children. Branson is in town today at the Times Summit on Global Health. Is this partially the reason that so many wealthy people are donating? Is because it seems to me George W. Bush's emergency plan for AIDS relief is a lie and a disaster. Is that true?
The
phone's breaking up. Sorry, Sir Richard Branson, we can't understand you anymore. Thank you for being with us. We have to get back to the show. There's something wrong with the phone.
Yeah.
It's 15 past the hour. That was a quick break with one of the wealthiest people in the world talking about how he's helping AIDS in Africa. Now we're going to get back to the confessions. So stay on the phone. We'll do that in a second. We've also got Slander Minute and a little bit of top news. Chris Elliott, a little fun today, if that's okay. We do that sometimes here. That's what makes us unique. 15 past Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Hi, this is former Labor Secretary Robert Reich, and you're listening to Mark Maron and Mark Riley. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
All right, 20 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
It's Morning Sedition. That's right, folks. It is Morning Sedition here on Air America Radio. It is Morning Sedition for the time being. I'll tell you, man, we got a few confessions still lined up here. I'm going to tell you a little bit more about what's going on here with me at Air America Radio a little later. We got Chris Elliott coming up. We got the Slander Minute. But right now, the confessional is still open. Chris in Iowa, how have you sinned? What is your sin, Chris?
Well, I'm bless me, brothers, for about to sin.
Yes, you're about to.
I've been a vegetarian for 12 years now, and I am literally right now sitting next to a sausage, egg, and cheese biscuit.
Oh my God, it's right there!
Don't pick it up,
dude. Wait, do you eat fish?
Yeah. Hey.
Okay, you eat fish. Okay, so I'm in the same boat as you, right?
I don't eat fish either. I don't eat anything with eyeballs. I don't eat anything with a mama. I haven't for 12 years.
That's the rule. No eyeballs, no mama.
That's right. And so I go in the restaurant to get an egg and cheese biscuit. I do this, you know, and they gave me the wrong one.
How does an egg not have a mama?
Because it's not, you know, it's too early. I don't want to get into the philosophical. Anyway, I'm sitting next to sausage.
Oh, man, dude.
It's swine.
Dude.
It's not even like just... chicken.
Oh, I know Riley can attest to that.
Yeah, man.
What can we do to help him? This is an intervention call. This dude is in trouble, man. He needs help. He's sitting there next to sausage, Riley.
Do I do with this thing? I can't throw it out the window. That's wasteful.
Can throw it out the window. It's not wasteful if you're not planning on eating it.
I think what you should do is give it to. Where are you in Iowa?
Where am I? I'm near Davenport, Iowa.
So is there anybody around that looks like they could use a sausage sandwich?
No, see, that's the thing. It's Iowa.
It's Iowa.
It's just corn. There's a cow. I'm not going to throw it to the... I don't know what to do. I'm like sitting next to a bomb here. I don't know what to say. Smells so good, Mark.
I know, dude. I know. Well, look, Chris, you know, are you still in the parking lot of the restaurant? You're driving? What are you doing?
I'm driving. I'm on my way to work.
Oh, man. Dude, I think you know what? It's time. It's time to give a surprise present to someone at work today.
There you go.
I know it's a weird present, but I'm sure I don't know where you work. If there's a cubicle situation, if you have a crush on somebody, go surprise.
I work at a high school. I'm a high school teacher.
Oh my God. Well, here it is.
Who ate
the
last test?
Here's your penance, Chris. You take that sandwich into your high school class. What do you teach?
I teach Spanish.
Okay, this is an interesting day. It's going to be an interesting day in Chris's Spanish class. Chris, you're going to go in there, and you're going to put that thing on the table and just let it sit there for a minute on your desk. And with the students are going to go, what the hell is this? And you say, this sandwich is causing me problems. And I want you to explain, to that class the virtues of vegetarianism and why you became a vegetarian. And then ask them, who wants to eat this sandwich now? And whoever raises their hand first, they get the sandwich.
Who wants my used sausage, egg, and cheese biscuits? Okay, I will. All right.
Well, thank you,
guys.
Thank you, Chris.
All right, man.
They, you know, spread the gospel of vegetarianism. Nothing with a, with, what was it? Nothing with a mama or...
Right. Or eyeballs.
Okay,
eyeballs.
Thank you, Chris. You take care. As we know, President Bush has picked a new nominee for Supreme Court judge. That is Samuel Alito. He looks more conservative than Harriet Myers, so a fight about this will probably go down party lines. It's a good story, but we thought we could spice it up, maybe tweak it a little on today's Morning Sedition Slander Minute. Here's our slander correspondent, Ted Fields. Ted, what can you add to this story?
Mark, I have it on the highest authority that Samuel Alito possesses weapons of mass destruction and poses a direct threat to our national security.
Wow, Ted, that's not even remotely believable.
Yes, well, that's just what Neville Chamberlain said at the Munich Pact of 1938.
What?
Sure, Judge Alito says he's cooperating with weapons inspectors, but do you really want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud, Mark?
You expect people to believe that a nominee to the United States Supreme Court is a foreign aggressor?
Sure. I've got bigger ambitions than Air America Radio, guys. I figured out I gotta go for the big lie if I want a job at the New York Times or Fox News. I've stopped resenting Judy Miller. I'm at peace about that. Wow. No, I'm just saying whatever she says. The White House will figure out how to play ball, and boom, I'm out of here. Big money. Uptown.
Yeah. Dude, though, Ted, Bush wants Samuel Alito on the Supreme Court. The White House doesn't want him torpedoed.
They want you to say something like, Alito is a legal genius or something.
Well, jeez, why doesn't anybody tell me these things?
Ted, come on, it's obvious. The lie has to be to Bush's advantage.
Hey, I want to sell out to this White House. I'll report whatever they want, but they gotta let me in the loop. My whole life, I felt left out.
Jeez, guy, settle.
I mean, I've tried everything. Jeff Gannon breezes by me for a White House press pass, and it turns out he was advertising a male escort service. I mean, if that's what they wanted, I could do that. If I applied myself.
Ted, maybe you should ask Jeff Gannon to help you out.
I asked. I said, who do you have to grease to get a break around here? He just pointed at everybody. I got to work on my abs.
Oh, this has been Morning Sedition Slander Minute.
I got abandonment issues.
Get out of here. What? Poor guy. You're confused. That's interesting. You know what's interesting about that, Barry, is you said something in your sketch.
Sure.
Ted.
Barry.
Yeah, let's just
Ted
drop
Barry.
The facade.
Hey, look, I've only got, you're going down the tube.
Exactly.
Anyway.
My time is limited here.
No,
we might as well let people let Barry Lank in on the party. Well, it's interesting you bring that up because I'm at Marino and Sons Fish getting my bluefish, my pigeon of the sea.
Okay.
I love bluefish. A lot of people don't like it. It's too dark, too fishy, whatever. The guys at Marino set me up. I tell them what's going on with me here at Air America, that the boss man, you know, wants me out for whatever reason. Who the hell knows? You know, whatever. Okay, I tell them what's going on. And he says, well, why don't you go do it with Rush? You know, go over with Rush. And yeah. I said, I can't do that. He's like, look, you know, it's so much easier on the other side. You know?
Yes, it is.
Well, when it's
we actually do believe
focused.
In this.
Yeah, exactly.
The sad part about it is, if we didn't believe in it, our lives would be so much easier. But
I know, man. I was close. I love doing this show. Did you hear that, Chris? I was close.
Uh-oh.
I'm upset. I tell you, I don't know. You know, I don't know. I'm telling my listeners again, look, you know, I don't know what's going to happen or how long this is going to go on for, you know, but something's going to change here. You know, I just want to make sure you know the truth. The truth is they didn't renew my contract. This is a gray area. My contract is up December 1st. I don't know what's going to happen or when it's going to happen, but I love you. Thanks for all your emails from all around the world. There's still a little fragment of hope here, but I don't know.
You're slowly fading out.
Yes. So, thanks, Barry. Now get out. All right. We're going to talk to Chris Elliott in a minute. He's funny. He'll be funny, unlike Barry Lang. 27 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Before past the hour, it's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition for the time being. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hey.
Look, you know, I'm going to get honest. Here, first of all, Chris Elliott, we got a little time here. Chris Elliott is stuck in traffic, so hopefully he'll show up right now. But I got to be honest with you. There was a little while back. This is what's going on. This is why, you know, we smelled something bad here at Morning Sedition. Outside of the fact that, you know, they've never publicized this show on this network. They just never have. But a few months ago, as you regular listeners know, remember when we were announcing, like, the big thing, big surprise, something big is going to happen, and then it just disappeared? Well, that was the first sign of when we knew, my staff and I, that's all of us, Brendan, Kalo, Mark Riley, you know, Dan Pashman, everybody here. Little Goliath wasn't here, and I don't think Crimmins, boy genius, was here. But we knew something was up because everyone got behind this thing. The publicity, here's what it was. We were gonna have a contest to hire an anarchist, a prankster, the guy to go out into the world to you know, raise our profile in New York and also to do wild things for political reasons. A politically motivated prankster was what we were gonna try to recruit. And we had everyone behind it, man. We had the ad people here, the marketing people. Everyone was go, 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 go. And then at the last minute, bam, CEO says, no, that ain't happening. Now, that was a few months ago, as you know. So, you know, the jig was up in his mind then. The thing that blows me away is that, you know, this is the guy that claims to know how the left lost teen spirit. That's his book. And here we are, the only show on this network that actually caters to people who are all ages, that actually does intentional creative comedy with a bunch of different characters. The only show that has a shot at bringing in people under 25 years old. The only show on this network that has a shot at bringing those people in, and we're being stifled. We're being stifled. I am, you know, my contract was not being renewed, and I'm getting email from India. I'm getting email from people from 20 to 70 right here. All right? The only show that had a shot at bringing in new voters, the guy who wrote How the Left Lost Teen Spirit, is the only guy saying no to this show. All right? So we'll see what happens with that. Chris Elliott should be here in a minute. Here's an interesting story. About 800 people who attended services at University Baptist Church in Waco, Texas, watched as the pastor, who was waist-deep in a baptism pool, reached for a microphone and electrocuted himself. Now, come on. How is that not funny? I'm sorry. That's wrong. Reverend Kyle Lake was pronounced dead at Hillcrest Medical Center down there in Texas. Now, Riley, does he get extra points for that?
Style points in purgatory?
Exactly. Let's say he's right. There is a heaven. He gets up there, and God goes, that was great. That was hilarious. Come on in. I got your chair right over here. And we got a mic that works. Is that what happens to that guy?
I don't know why you would. I mean, there is some really basic electric stuff that you learn in grade school about, you know, standing in water and grabbing onto something electric.
Yeah.
And there's just something that, you know, I mean, it's like going out to a radio transmitter. You do the wrong thing at a radio transmitter, you get electrocuted the same way.
Yeah, so let's talk about what you just said on the break. That, you know, I'm getting concerned about this Samuel Alito nomination. There's rumblings now that the Democrats aren't even going to try to filibuster Riley.
Well, Dick Durbin's number two Senate Democrat says don't rush to judgment on Alito, saying, quote, I don't think we should assume that's going to happen at all, talking about a filibuster.
Dude, does he know what this guy did?
He said, I don't think we should race to a conclusion here. Ordinarily, it takes 6 to 8 weeks to evaluate a Supreme Court nominee. We shouldn't rush to judgment.
What the hell? Whose side is that guy on?
His own?
Oh my God.
I don't know. He's the number two senator, right behind Harry Reid.
Unbelievable. This Samuel Alito stands for everything that we're against. He wants to take down Roe v. Wade. He's against affirmative action. It's not clear. I think he's hostile towards the people who are disability or discriminated. In this case, in the Fanson versus the Medical College of Pennsylvania, the majority said the standard for proving disability-based discrimination articulated in Alito's dissent was so restrictive that, quote, few, if any, cases would survive summary judgment. This guy doesn't even like people who are handicapped. Is that the wrong word? Disabled, sorry.
Yeah, there's a lot of that in his record. I looked at the record in terms of a dissent he wrote with regard to a woman who had sued the Marriott Corporation for race discrimination, and he was equally blind and obtuse there. But what's scary about this, Mark, and why some people are a little pessimistic about the ability to stop this guy, is that there are a number of Republican senators who signed on to that Gang of 14 resolution. That would be the resolution that said that there would be no filibusters as long as the candidates were not too extreme and they wouldn't invoke the nuclear option. They're saying that Alito is not too extreme, and if the Democrats try to filibuster, they will invoke the nuclear option. Now, the nuclear option means it would not take 60 senators, to end a filibuster, only a majority. That's the nuclear option.
Oh, this is awful. This is, if these bastards hadn't stole the election, we could have stopped this.
Well, yeah.
If they haven't done everything they could, man, I just wish. I swear, if I were a Democrat that didn't vote, I'd be feeling pretty stinky and guilty right now. That's for sure, because we knew this was coming. It turns out Chris Elliott has showed up. If you don't know Chris Elliott, you do. For those of you who are old enough to remember the original Letterman show, he was the guy that came out of the floor. For those of you who saw the movie Cabin Boy, he was that guy. He's had a few things on TV. His father was Bob Elliott
and Ray Goulding.
That's right. Bob and Ray. They were one of the originators of what we're doing right here.
Radio
in this studio.
Icons.
That's right. What we're doing in this studio right now. Well, Chris Elliott is here. He's got a new book out. He's going to be in the studio soon. I assume that I will continue to hold my seat until at least the end of that interview. I could be disappeared at any second. That's it. 40 past. Chris Elliott coming up next. Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
You're listening to Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
No, we're not homosexual, but we are willing to learn.
Air America Radio.
Past the hour, it's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
This is Air America Radio's Morning Sedition for the time being. Our next guest is an Emmy Award-winning writer, comedian, and actor, now turned novelist. His first novel, The Shroud of the Thwacker, hits newsstands in October. Chris Elliott joins us in the studio this morning. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Mark. Good morning.
Good morning.
Mark.
So, Chris, you had a brilliant show on the air called Get a Life that was taken off. Despite the fact that it was a great show, how'd that feel?
Oh, come on, you know.
I do know.
It is kind of a liberating thing, you know, to see the writing on the wall, because then you just kind of, you know, pull out all the stops and do whatever the hell you want. In my case, second season of Get a Life, you know, we pretty much just, I would come in, I remember when I knew the show was going to be canceled, I would come in and I would see stuff in the script like, oh, you're going to be in a vat of chili, you know. And I'd go, no, I'm not. I'm canceled. I'm not going to do that. And so we would, you know, we'd end up, you know, inevitably ripping my head off and kicking it down the street because we had no ending. I would go home early.
Hey, Brendan, make note of that vat of chili for tomorrow. Vat of chili. So, you know, I love you. I think you're funny. I'm excited that you got a book out. Now, we are doing radio. Your father did radio. I imagine that you grew up in a radio studio to some degree, did you not?
Yeah, I did. And I did. So our whole house was actually a radio studio.
Is that true?
Well, no, you know what I remember the most about my dad? And I used to go in and I used to listen to him. My dad was part of Bob and Ray, this comedy team, and he was Bob, or I like to say, or Ray. I get the two of them confused. But I used to, summers, I never went to camp, but I used to go into his studio, and he used to sit me in front of the sound effects machine.
Oh!
You know, headsets on me, and I just sit for hours and put these carts in and listen to, you know, 5 seconds of a Wolfman howl, you know, like every variation.
It was the greatest thing,
you
right?
know, or you know, punches. You
yeah.
Know.
I have.
Oh, you got something. Oh, wait a minute. He can't hear me. He doesn't have the headphones on.
I don't have my cans on.
Oh, put your cans on, man.
Cans.
What do we got? We've got. Now I'm gonna just do this. Yeah.
Oh, there it is.
Oh, that. Wow, that brings back so many memories. Yeah. But I got to tell you, those are newer.
Whoa.
Yes. Those are newer fights.
And it's all in one machine here. You don't have to pull tapes out and put them in.
That's right. Yeah. But when I was at school, whenever I used to fight with my friends, they were always amazed at the sound effects that I could come up with. Because, did you really hit me just then? That was amazing.
You got to settle a dispute I've had with a couple of people for a long, long time. I want to focus on the book, but I got to ask you this. There was a bit that your father did called Mary Backstage Noble Wife.
Right.
Now,
right.
Was that the template for Mary Hartman?
No.
It wasn't.
But Mary Backstage was a parody of radio soap operas.
Yeah.
And Mary Hartman was a parody of TV soap
operas. TV soap operas. Okay.
Right, so now, similar. Yeah, definitely similar. So the Shroud of the Thwacker,
yes.
I would expect no less from you. what does that even mean? What is it about?
It's about a serial killer in the turn of the century, and Ripper was already taken. So he used Thwacker.
Is he bitter about Ripper being taken?
Yeah, right.
Well, he's from New York City, so he wanted to coin his own phrase. No, it's a historical crime thriller that takes place in 1892. But I've virtually done no research on the time period whatsoever. So everything.
Why bother?
Exactly.
Why speculate?
Exactly.
You know? People have a short memory.
I've done my book reports when I was in school.
Now you got Teddy Roosevelt in this book.
Yes.
You've had a long-standing fascination with the Roosevelts. Why?
Yeah, you know, somebody pointed that out because I did do a one-man show about Franklin Roosevelt,
yeah.
You know, FDR one-man show. But the truth of that wasn't really, I don't have an obsession with the Roosevelts, but that one-man show was not really, I had seen this one-man show with Robert Vaughn doing FDR.
Sure. Man from Uncle?
It was Robert Vaughn.
Napoleon Solo was doing Franklin Roosevelt. And
right.
So my one-man show was really a parody of that. It wasn't really thinking, I wanted to make fun of Franklin Roosevelt. It was more like
But you do a good job of making fun of Teddy in this.
Yes, I do make Teddy kind of a cartoonish character in this. And there's a number of people in this book. There's Liz Smith is in the book. And there's another person who I can't name, but she lives in the Dakota. Just put it that way.
How many people do we know that live there?
Well, she's of Japanese
descent. Roberta Flack? Uh-huh.
And she's rumored to have destroyed the greatest band that ever lived.
There you go.
Okay.
There you go.
So now I just drifted to New Hampshire for a minute. When I wasn't
listening on it. So. Doesn't matter.
That's great. Your name again? No. I was listening, but when he brought up Teddy Roosevelt, there was a place up in New Hampshire we used to do comedy called TR's, and it was a restaurant owned by a guy who was obsessed with Teddy Roosevelt.
Really?
And in the restaurant, every part of the restaurant was plastered with Teddy Roosevelt paraphernalia, and the guy kind of dressed like him and had it was called TR's.
Oh,
it was
wow.
insane. So you'd stand up on stage surrounded by Teddy Roosevelt paraphernalia.
Right. Well,
sounds like a book signing opportunity.
Yeah, exactly. I was just, let's get that address.
TR's, I think it's in New Hampshire.
All right.
So now what is the story? What happens to the serial killer in the book?
Don't give away the ending. Yeah, sure. My book's about the investigation of these unsolved murders that I'm saying took place in 1882, and the investigation was headed up by the chief of police, Caleb Spencer, mm-hmm. who was head of the NCNYPD, which stands for 19th Century New York Police Department, and Liz Smith, his girlfriend, Teddy Roosevelt, and they never solved it. And at some point in my investigation, I discover a time machine. I'm hurled back into 1882 and possibly accused of the actual crimes myself.
Uh oh.
So that's
leave it
good.
At that.
Time travel. It's got all the elements.
It's
not
got
only that,
everything.
You know, the 1882 New York Police Department was quite a piece of work by itself. Because actually, I think for a while there were two police departments in New York.
I don't know.
Was two police departments.
You may very well be right. I watched the History Channel a couple of times, and that was about it.
Just make notes. It's not even about what time. It's not even a decade-specific thing. It's like, now we're in ancient Rome, and she drove her car up to the Parthenon.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, the challenge here was to try to weave a story that made any kind of sense. And, I'm not sure it does, but it does have a beginning and a middle and an end.
No. At least it says that. Finally.
It says the beginning, it says the middle, about halfway through, and then it says the end, just so you know.
So, but you're comedically, you've always been sort of you've come from that place where it's sort of timeless. It can be absurd. It doesn't need to have a narrative structure. I think you have a lot more freedom like that, and it's also some of the most challenging comedy to pull off.
I guess so. I mean, it's always sort of come naturally for me, and I don't know why. I think it started at Letterman, where there was always this kind of strange... You know, I started on that show playing this guy who was unbalanced, who worked on the staff, who desperately wanted to be a TV star, and would come out and bother Dave from time to time. And there was a lot of truth to that, though, in who I was.
Yeah.
So even to me, you know, reality and what I've started to make up are, you know, is kind of a blurred thing.
Now, are you
life.
Are you doing more TV? You got any movies coming up?
I'm developing another show for Warner Brothers. But you know, the truth is, I've been in development almost every year since Get a Life, and it's very hard to get. I'll go in and I'll talk to a network, and they'll all say they loved Get a Life. They grew up with it. It was their favorite show. And then the next thing they'll say is, you know, we don't want you to do that show anymore. You know, we want to see you with a wife and kids and settled down and all that, which is, you know, a dangerous area for me to venture into.
Why? Do you have a...
Well, I do have a wife and kids, but, you know, for the general public to accept me as that, I think would be a large challenge.
It's a great challenge, though. You could be the guy. Maybe you should have, like, a delusional wife and kids. They're not even real. They're just a hallucination that comes sometimes.
Maybe that's the case.
I'm brainstorming with you here. I'm trying to work with you
here. That's very funny. And maybe suddenly you're making me think, do I have a wife and kids? I know I'm putting one through college. But
wow, that
somebody
must be
I'm
wild.
Putting through college.
Yeah, that comes home occasionally.
Exactly.
And asks for money.
Exactly. Yeah.
How old are your kids?
18 and 15.
Wow. Oh, they're funny?
Yeah. They're both much funnier than I am. They both want to go into the business.
Oh, my God. What do you say to that?
Encouraging or discouraging?
I can't discourage them, but at the same time, you know, it's such a hard business for anybody, and for women especially, it's a very difficult business. But, you know, the thing I keep telling them is just to try to, you know, do more than just act or anything else. You know,
they're both
girls? Try to write both girls.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and so the 15-year-old knows more about comedy than I do.
Really?
She tells me, she turns me on to, you know, who's hot and what's, you know, happening, you know.
And do you think that they're generally as funny as she thinks they are? Do you think that comedy is as healthy as it once was? Because you're one of these interesting guys that actually has the opportunity to see really a generational history of comedy, because you grew up with it.
Right,
and
right.
Now you've seen this this crashing of the wave. Obviously, there are a few people, my contemporaries and people that you know, that are very funny. But in general, culturally, where do you think comedy's at?
Well, I do think it's a cyclical thing. I mean, I just did this thing with Alan Zweibel, who's, you know, an idol of mine and was one of my heroes. You know, one of the original writers of Saturday Night Live, and it's, you know, the trends, you know, in comedy have always changed. You know, Saturday Night Live changed up everything. You know, people were watching, you know, the Carol Burnett show before that happened.
Yeah, right.
You know, and suddenly that was this whole new thing. So, you know, I don't know if Bob and Ray, if they had started right now, would necessarily have a following, you know, but maybe 5 years from now, if they did, they would, you know, it changes all the
time. It's hard to know. Do you like, are there shows that you're into right now? I mean,
I can't watch sitcoms. To me, it's like watching work. I can hear a network note. I can hear a rewritten line. And in some cases, literally, I can hear the executive producer laughing off to the side, you know, while the thing's happening.
Well, have you done that with your daughters? Have you said, let's play network pitch, where you're the executive, and maybe the older one plays the show creator, and the younger one is the talent?
I'm going to write that down. Network pitch.
No,
actually, what I'm trying to pitch is a show with an 18-year-old and a 15-year-old, so I can get them started in the business.
Perfect.
And get them my foot off
there
them.
You go.
I hope that they let you do that.
You know who they have? They turn me on to... you know who I like is Stella. Do you like those guys?
Yeah, I know those guys.
I like those guys.
Personally, I had problems with one of them.
Oh, okay.
But the two of them
I don't know them personally. But, but that kind of humor makes me laugh.
That's
a lot.
Sort of like you like their sketches or their dynamic, because they do a
I
kind
like
of
their
a lounge,
dynamic. I the like the fact
show.
That that. What they it just to me it's sort of a it's like what the Marx Brothers were right now you know it's like a different it's an updated version.
Well, I wish
that.
One of them didn't talk, but I mean but outside of that they're great. So are you going to be sneaking in any movies that we should heads up for?
I just did a thing in Scary Movie 4.
Oh, great.
Thank you.
Good for you.
Thank you very much. Well, let me put it in, I don't turn anything down.
Uh-oh. You and Michael Caine. That's
exactly.
Hey, there's nothing wrong with working. All right, our guest has been Chris Elliott. The book is The Shroud of the Thwacker. You can look for him in Scary Movie 4 and perhaps, you know, in a development situation
if you live soon.
In Hollywood. So thanks for joining us. It's great having you.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Well, look, tomorrow we've got Mark Green, of course.
Mark Green, Jim Wallace, Larry Beanhart, and a vat of chili.
And that's right, a vat of chili. And Morning's Edition will return to O'Neill's Restaurant on Thursday, November 3rd, 64th, between Broadway and Central Park West.
That's right. It's been a good one, Marin.
It has, Riley. Thank you.
See you tomorrow, Air America Radio.